Hello once again, listeners, and welcome to the Leading with Integrity podcast. One of the many critical skills that any good leader or manager has is the ability to have difficult conversations effectively and with productive outcomes, and ideally in a way that at the end of the conversation, nobody's storming out of the room or quitting their jobs. My guest today is Beth Wantson, who is an expert at working with leaders to help them navigate those difficult conversations.
Welcome to the Leading with Integrity podcast.
Leadership talk for the modern manager.
With your host, David Hatch.
Well, firstly, Beth, thank you for joining me today and taking time out of your day. Much appreciated, and it's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Awesome. I say here, it's virtual, isn't it? We're not really here as such, but everyone knows what I mean when I say that, hopefully. Yes. A great place for us to start then, as with all guests really, is to ask you to tell us a bit more about you and your career background, your story so far, if you like, and how you've got to where you are and what you're doing today.
Great. Well, I'm an author and a speaker and a consultant and coach to C-suite executives and their organizations. I'm based in Sacramento, California, but I work all over the U.S. and in parts of Europe. I've been doing this for about 20 years. My journey started, however, when I was working in a company and I got tapped to lead the team that I was actually on. As thrilled as I was about that, what I quickly came to realize was I knew a lot about the work. I knew nothing about how to motivate, inspire, empower humans and hold them accountable. I had received no training in that. The first kind of shocker to me was every Thursday evening, we would go out for cocktails and dinner as a group, and we'd complain about management. And the first Thursday that I was the new manager of the team, I got up and came out to see where we were going for cocktails, and everybody was gone. Because now here I'm management, right? So I'm no longer part of that group. I tried so many things. I read books. I tried different things, all of that. But I didn't realize how much I was leading with my emotions versus really leading with the knowledge of how the human brain works, how employees are inspired, motivated, and empowered. And so I did that for 13 years, and we were very successful. But I really was committed to learning more about what drives humans and what helps them have satisfaction and fulfillment at work and how a leader can impact that. And so that's how I ended up starting my own company. The more I learned, the more I realized this was needed to be taught within organizations. So I started my own company in 2015 based on my methodology that I developed, navigating challenging dialogue. And here we are. I've been going ever since.
Well, it's kind of a sad story, actually, the going out for drinks and being left behind. I feel bad for you. Yeah,
I wasn't happy, but I realized that as you elevate within an organization, you need to form a new home team, a new group of peers. Things change as you go into management and your perspective has to change. So it was very interesting. I also learned as I became part of the leadership team of the company, I also began to learn why a lot of decisions that I really didn't understand as an employee, why they had to be made or why things had to be done that way, which really got me interested in how communication can really help support the effectiveness of an organization.
Yeah, that's always an interesting one. I had a similar experience myself, actually. When you suddenly sort of, there's that arbitrary line, isn't there? And until you cross it, you're not allowed to be in the know. And that just, to me, it's such an inefficient way of managing people. If you don't tell people what's going on, then they don't really understand what they're doing or why half the time.
Right. People need context, particularly adults, need context to make decisions. right? And just even when the decision is, do I buy in or do I not buy in? People need context for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so through that journey then so far, what's been your biggest professional challenge, would you say, if you had to pick one?
I think my biggest professional challenge is that when you are the founder and the owner of a company, and suddenly you can get as much consultation as you want for decision making, problem solving, all of that, but the buck really stops with you. And that can be, it can be lonely at times. I have great people on my team who I consult with, get their feedback, get their input. The way that I run my company is, people are allowed to challenge my decisions, in a healthy way. We can have healthy conflict, but then at the end of the day, it stops with me. I have to make that decision, and whether or not, you know, we make payroll, we continue, we have business, that's all on me. COVID and the pandemic was a very challenging time, because up until then, we were on the road traveling probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks out of every month, going to clients, working with clients, doing that type of thing. Then the pandemic hit. Luckily, we had already begun doing a portion of our work online, so we had the systems in place. We were set up for that. But it took a little while for me personally and for the company, mentally, spiritually, and process-wise, to get our legs under us. So that was rough. I mean, the earth shifted, and you had no choice but to shift with it. That was the only option. And so I think that was one of the biggest challenges.
So two challenges then, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, the solo decision-making, yeah, I get where you're coming from. I found it, if I'm honest, quite liberating as well, because you're kind of free of the shackles of going through that whole management structure every time you need to make the smallest decision.
Well, and I grew up in a family of business people that started and ran their own businesses from the time I was a small child. My parents were running a pretty big business on our home property. And so it wasn't as foreign to me as it might be to some people.
Yeah, well, that's good. You kind of had that advantage then. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and COVID, obviously. I mean, I've yet to meet anyone who wasn't impacted by that. I suppose I was quite fortunate myself, actually, with my business. I mean, on the one hand, we'd only been going sort of 6 months when the first lockdown hit, so it was a bit stressful, if I'm honest. But on the other hand, I was already working out of my home anyway at that point, and had been since the start of the business. So on the one hand, it was a massive adjustment and a huge shock and a bit of panic. But on the other hand, it was kind of business as usual, really.
Yes. Well, yeah. What we decided to do, and it wasn't my idea, it was one of my team's brilliant idea. The first 3 months, we did a free webinar series on managing remotely. So every week we put out new content. Anybody could join, and it's still available on our website. Anybody can download it. But all the, how do you manage remotely? How do you deal with your own emotions? How do you give feedback when the person isn't right there in front of you? All of those things. And we just did that every week. We got together and we got a pretty large following of people who would come, because managers just didn't even know how to respond to the fact that all of a sudden they couldn't see their people. They weren't right there in front of them. So now, how do you measure success? How do you support them? How do you manage them? Do you even dare give them feedback? And so that was a great shift that we made, and it was really beneficial.
Yeah, it sounds like a very useful tool, actually. Yeah, I mean, even today, I'm sure a lot of people benefit from that.
Yes, it's all on the website. It's all free. Anybody can get it. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. How did you become interested in kind of helping people navigate those difficult conversations?
Well, once I realized that when I was showing up, right, to lead my team, I was showing up with all my emotional stuff. So I had two teenage daughters at the time. If I was having a hard time with my daughters when I got to the office, I was stressed. if there was budget pressure or pressure from above on me or my team, I was stressed when I walked in the door and I brought that with me. If I was having an absolute great day, I was happy bath. You know, I was like, hey, let's all go to lunch. You know, I'll buy. It's a great day. My mood was shifting with my emotions, and that was not consistent for my team. We were very high performing. We did great. Awesome. But when I think back on that, that's time that they spent trying to navigate which Beth was going to show up that day was time that they could have been working on things that they're working on. A perfect example of this and how I applied it is I was called in to work at an organization where the board of directors brought me in because the leader was hitting all the targets. She was, the budget was in the black. She was doing a fabulous job and had been for years, but she was wreaking havoc with her staff based on how she showed up emotionally. And I went in for a couple days of observation and I noticed that people would ask each other, what's the weather? Hey, what's the weather today? And somebody would answer, oh, it looks like there might be a storm. Oh, it's a bright sunny day. And finally I said, what is all this weather talk? And they said, oh, that's our code. If somebody needs to go in and talk to her, they first ask, what's the weather? So that they can get a read on what kind of mood she's in before they go in there. And that's part of what we do as leaders, that we don't even realize the impact we're having on our team when they have to spend that time. So that's what really got me interested in understanding how to help leaders manage their own emotions, be aware of their own emotions, and understand how that impacts communication.
Yeah, I mean, the fact they felt the need to come up with a code so that no one realized what they're talking about, that's a red flag all by itself, isn't it?
Exactly. I'm like, okay, I know my job now. I know what my job is here to do, to help this become more aware of her emotions so that she can proactively manage them so they're not impacting her staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about your approach then and some of those common challenges that it helps to solve.
Sure. So the approach is called Navigating Challenging Dialogue. It's a four-stage process, and it's all based on brain-based research and what we know about social and emotional intelligence. And many people have heard of crucial conversations. So I love crucial conversations. I love that book and that program. However, what I find is that is much more focused on how do you communicate in ways that help other people to do things or get other people to do things, right? It's really focused on how my behavior supports others. This program is really focused on who am I, how do I show up, and how do I understand when I'm either feeling vulnerable, I'm feeling triggered, when something is really getting under my skin. How do I recognize that? And then how do I impact that? Right. So, and how do I make sure that I can feel the full range of my emotions, but bring myself back to center when I'm in conflict, problem solving, giving feedback, any of those things. Also, what I learned through my work is that there's so many conversations that should be had early on, and people do all kinds of things to avoid them. We create workarounds. We don't give people feedback. We hint. We do all of these things, and I have a very robust coaching business. So many times people will call me for coaching on a challenge with an employee that if they just had a conversation in the beginning, they wouldn't be in this big, huge mess now. And so we also have a component of that, which is around mastering feedback. Everything you were never taught about how to give feedback. And so how do we give feedback? How do we incorporate that so it becomes a norm of our leadership? So people don't see it as like, oh my God, feedback, it's a special event. What are they going to say? It's just part of what happens. I give feedback. You ask for feedback. You leaders get feedback from their employees. And these are the things that create a work culture, the ability to have tough conversations in an empathetic, kind, and clear way, the ability to give feedback and having a culture of feedback. These are the things that create work environments that have empathy, trust, and work satisfaction. And when you have empathy, trust, and work satisfaction, people become more loyal. They want to stay at the organization. And so you have to deal less with retention. You're supporting people to do their work. And so that's what the program is. It's a very clear-cut four-step process that we teach people to use so that they can be clean and clear in their communication.
Wow, sounds really helpful. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting example about the kind of the difficult conversations and avoiding them. And avoiding is the easiest option, isn't it, for a lot of managers? You just kind of ignore the problem and hope it'll go away, or hope they forget about it, or decide they don't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah. Or the worst thing, which is they keep worrying about it. They vent to family and friends and anybody they can find. And if you think of cartoon characters, they walk around with these thought bubbles above their head, right? The little dots go up, and that's thoughts. Those thoughts are invisible to everybody except for them. No one else can see the thoughts. And so that's what happens when we put off conversations, is that thought bubble gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then by the time we have the conversation, it's usually not, barely holds the thread of what the facts are. And it's all about thoughts, assumptions, suspicions, unspoken things we didn't say, our fears, all of that. That all comes tumbling out, and now you've got a big bunch of drama and chaos that you have to either apologize for, feel bad for, sort out, figure out, right? And so what we teach people is how to really get that thought bubble out on paper and then begin to sift out all of the things, your biases, your unspoken expectations, everything, so that you can get to what are the three or four core facts that this conversation is really about? And then how do you deliver them in a way that someone can take action on them? Someone can actually do something with it versus this whole verbal, you know, download, emotional download that people are like, I don't even know what to do with that. Or they get defensive, or they get, they justify, or they quit.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, the lesson I think out there for those managers out there is, it might in the short term feel easier to put off, procrastinate, not deal with the problem. But actually, you know, the bigger that thought bubble gets, the more of it you're going to have to wade through before you get to what was actually the original problem you didn't want to deal with. And a whole bunch of that is going to be quite acrimonious because the other person is going to be quite upset that you haven't dealt with it before.
Yes, yes. And the people who work with them and around them are wondering, why isn't this being dealt with? Or why isn't any conversation happening about this? And so trust and morale really begin to take a significant hit when you allow someone to languish without addressing head on what's happening.
Yeah, the classic example that I've seen a few times is when it comes time for pay review. And suddenly the boss is less available or on holiday or out of the office.
Yes. Yeah,
that one gets quite nasty.
If I had my way, I would get rid of annual performance evaluations. And people would be having feedback conversations and coaching conversations all the time. And then at whatever interval you determine is reasonable, The review is only about what are your goals for next year, and what is the raise or the bonus, right? And if you're doing it that way, there's no surprise, right? It's like, you know, waiting and waiting and waiting for your birthday or Christmas or something, and there's either a big surprise or a big letdown. So in my mind, nobody should ever be surprised when it's time for an annual performance review, because those conversations should have been happening the whole way through.
Absolutely agree with you there. Yeah. And I always prefer to kind of separate the two conversations as far as possible, particularly when it's something where there might be different kind of opinions or viewpoints on performance. Like the employee might think they're doing a brilliant job and their manager might see it slightly differently, but linking their salary, their remuneration to that, what could be an argument or differing points of views, it creates this kind of unpleasant sense sometimes, doesn't it? That you're feeling maybe being held to ransom almost if you don't do it the way the manager wants. And yeah, it's all quite unpleasant, I think.
Well, that's one of the reasons why feedback is so difficult, because we all have a self-concept, right, of how we're doing, how we show up, how we perform. And what we believe about ourselves is generally elevated. It's generally higher. That's why if you go to the doctor and they say, how many times a week do you exercise? And you say, I exercise 3 times a week. They say, yeah, okay. And they kind of make an assumption that maybe you exercise 1 or 2, right? Because we elevate, we just naturally have a higher self-concept. So when someone gives feedback, you are literally disrupting self-concept. And that's why often people react badly to feedback, because they begin to get kind of triggered, if you will, or an emotional hotspot gets activated. Their amygdala literally tells them, their brain literally says, you need to protect yourself. And so people either shut down or go into fight or flight mode, which looks like defending, justifying, blaming, attacking, right? Well, you're late a lot too, right? Or you miss deadlines also. Why are you talking to me about this? So when we understand how that happens, we understand the importance of creating a culture where feedback and tough conversations are the norm. They're not the exception to the rule, because we resist them because we don't want to suffer the discomfort of witnessing somebody whose self-concept has been disrupted, right? So the leader's trying to protect themselves. They think they're trying to protect the employee, but they're actually trying to protect themselves from experiencing that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like the phrase disrupting self-concept as well. That's really well put. I like it. So working with executives and managers and teaching that approach is, I guess, most of what you do. But I guess you can use these kind of techniques and these skills in everyday life as well.
Oh, every time we do a training, every time I work with anybody, I always hear back about how they applied it with their teenager, how they applied it with their mother-in-law or their spouse or whatever the case is, how they used it in the community, if they're in a volunteer group or a volunteer board or something, how they use the techniques there. The technique is the same regardless where you implement it. And so a lot of people say to me, why do you work with companies and big organizations and agencies as opposed to individuals? And the reason I do that predominantly is because that's where we are for the biggest chunk of our life. So my goal and my mission is to reduce drama and chaos and give people tools for how to have conversations when we don't agree and align. And we need to do that in all places in the world, now more than ever, because many of the challenges and problems that we're facing are so complex that if we can't come together and have hard conversations about them, we're not going to solve them. And we're not going to sustain. You and I were talking at the beginning, I think before we were on air, about, you know, global warming, right? If we can't come together and talk about these really difficult topics, even with people we don't agree with, we're in for a world of hurt and trouble. And so everybody needs to learn this. I work in companies because that's where humans are for the majority of their time. So that's where I get access to them.
Yes, we're in danger of verging on the point where I get on my soapbox about how we have arguments and critical thinking and all these sort of things that I'm always whinging to my mates about over a beer or whatever. You know, there's two issues, isn't it? I think that I won't harp on about it too much, but I think one is the critical thinking element. You know, I'm not sure what it's like in the States, but certainly over here in the UK, it's not something that's really taught as much as it used to be or as it should be. When you throw social media into the mix and all of the dreaded algorithm, it all starts to get a bit sort of self-repeating and self-fulfilling and horrible. I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
And then you combine that as well with, we now seem to be, as a society, almost in a place where you can't be friends with someone who has an opposite political opinion to you. You can't have a friendly disagreement anymore. It's always a, well, you disagree with me, so I hate you.
Well, and the reason for that is because when our values feel threatened, literally your amygdala sends a message to your body saying you are vulnerable and you are at risk. And so it then activates the whole chemical system in your body that says, I either need to fight or I need to disappear, right? Back in the day, it used to be that saber-tooth tiger was going to eat your baby. It was those types of risks. Now, the risks that we experience are more related to our ego, our reputation, our sense of self. All of those types of things are values. But we still have the same reaction, which is either I'm going to start typing away and set you straight and call you names and everything. That's fight, right? Or I'm going to block you. I'm going to unfriend you. I'm never going to speak to you again. That's flight. So it's a very human reaction. And what we teach in Navigating Challenging Dialogue is how to recognize when that's happening so that you can hack it. You can hack that automatic process and you can use discernment. You can use all of your skills and ability to understand what the facts are, to be curious and learn about others' perspective and view, because we all show up with our own lens on something. It's based on your culture, your family traditions, your education, your work style, your communication, all of those things, your temperament, all make up how you view the world. But we walk around thinking that everybody views the world the same as we do. Or if they don't, they're an idiot, right? How could they not? That's what we've been taught to believe. And that's what we've been conditioned to believe, particularly over the last 8 or 10 years. And so we need to learn the skills to show up differently. I am so 100% convinced of this. This is the truth. I want to address what you said about critical thinking. In the States, it's very similar. So in schools, it's really about test scores. It's really about getting the work done, getting the tasks done. It's about seat time, how much time you're there in school. And the critical thinking stuff is not being addressed. But what companies are learning is that they have to have people who can think critically in order to survive, sustain, to innovate, to create, to solve the difficult problems. So companies are now realizing that the way people are being educated is not serving them at all. And so this work that I'm doing is helping people to develop those skills that they didn't even realize they had or that they needed. The stuff that I'm teaching is not taught in management training, business school, college, or in traditional education.
I think for me, it comes down to, you know, at school, they don't necessarily teach you as much as they maybe used to. They teach you how to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, once you've passed the test, you never have to do that test again. You know, you're not going to see that test in your work life. You know, I mean, barring some sort of fluke of probability, the chances of that exact question scenario happening in your actual professional life are pretty much none.
And this is not the fault of teachers, and it's not the fault of administrators. This is the decisions that are being made at the bureaucratic level. Mm. That are then coming down as policy and mandates. And that's why, I don't know about in your country, but in the US, we have so many teachers and education leaders that are fleeing from the industry. There's such a teacher shortage here because it's so much less about the craft and the art of teaching.
Well, sadly inevitable, isn't it, when you link access to funding to test performance?
Yep. Yep.
That's how it was going to happen, isn't it? You know, there's no other outcome, really.
I know.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's a shame. Yeah. Well, getting off my soapbox now, moving back then to your approach and your process, I mean, is there any ways it can go wrong?
Absolutely. 100%. Because humans are unpredictable, right? And so this process teaches you, the person who needs to have the tough conversation, it helps you go through the four steps to prepare to do that, to be able to communicate, talking about the facts, to communicate with empathy and curiosity and a focus on the good of the whole. What is the outcome that you desire for yourself, for the other person, and for the whole by having the conversation? But you have no control over how the other person receives the information or what they do with it. So that's the challenging part. The biggest thing I work with leaders on is to understand the program has what we call mantras. They're the guiding principles of the program. And one is, the only person I can manage is myself. And so I can only manage how I show up in that conversation, what my energy is like, what intention I'm bringing, what I communicate, how clear and clean I am emotionally when I show up. I have no control over how the other person is going to show up, right? And the other one that applies here is that I can't make other people happy. And that's a big misconception by leaders and managers, is that their job is to make their employees happy. It is not. That is not your job. Your job is to motivate, inspire, empower, and hold people accountable so that they can use their unique strengths and talents in service of the goals of the organization. And what the research tells us is, when people are able to do that, when they are able to use their unique strengths and talents in service of the greater good, then they have work satisfaction. Now, work satisfaction can lead to happiness. It absolutely can. But there's not enough pizza parties or employee of the month awards or special parking spots that will help an employee that is not experiencing work satisfaction be happy, right? And someone can be experiencing work satisfaction and have other factors in their life outside the work environment that are causing them to be unhappy. So we have to operate from the premise that this is our domain. This is what we can do. This is how we can contribute. And then we have to trust that our employees are whole and capable of managing their happiness on their own. They can access counseling services. They can make changes. They can do all kinds of things. So when it can go wrong is when the leader is really trying to achieve happiness on behalf of the employee. Because that is not your job. You can't do it. It's not possible. It's not even your business to make your employee happy. That's their business, is their own happiness. So that's really when it can go wrong, is when we're striving for the wrong outcome. And then if it does go wrong and somebody behaves horribly and they have a really bad reaction, then you have a different conversation, which is a feedback conversation about what behaviors and attitudes need to be in place for them to be effective in doing their job, right? So then it just shifts to a different conversation.
I see where you're coming from. I agree, you know, any system that has a human element in it, it doesn't matter what it is, it's always going to be subject to go wrong, regardless of how well planned that system is or how good it is. Totally agree with you there. The question of happiness, I'm not so sure. I don't know. I think I see where you're coming from when you say it's not the leader's job. I think it should be an outcome a leader wants. And I think at the very minimum, it is the leader's job to not make people unhappy.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Do no harm. Right.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I mean, there is research out there as well that shows quite clearly, you know, happy employees are more productive and will stay with your organization longer, and you'll end up with much better results for your business at the end of it. So for that reason, I think it should be a goal of leaders. And I think, you know, a lot of the things you were talking about there, I see that as part of the leader's job anyway. And if it results in employee happiness, then job done, isn't it? I mean,
that's the key right there. Yeah. If it results in employee happiness, that's great. That's awesome. But it depends on how you define happiness, right?
True.
So some people conflate happiness with job satisfaction. Job satisfaction is really the most important thing. People feeling satisfied, accomplished, empowered to do their work. And that can lead to happiness. I am not saying don't care, you know, whether or not your employees are happy. But many times I will say, why did you not have the conversation with the employee in the beginning? And people say, because I don't want them to be unhappy, right? And that's the challenge. There are times when we are going to hear information about our performance, we're going to get feedback that is going to make us uncomfortable. There are times when a company is going to have to make decisions that are going to make us uncomfortable. It's going to make us uncomfortable. But if we avoid communicating those so that we can have people be quote unquote happy as opposed to experiencing discomfort, that's a problem. That's a problem. So that's what I'm talking about right there. Of course, we want people to be happy. Yes.
Yeah. No, I think it's, I mean, it's short-termism, isn't it, versus long-term. I think,
yes.
You know, I didn't want to have the difficult conversation because it might have made them unhappy when, ironically, in the long run, you've made them unhappy by not having that conversation, because eventually they'll get to the point where they're either sacked or they leave because they can't do the job anymore.
Or worse, they stay forever and be miserable and non-productive, right?
Yeah, indeed. All right, so let's talk about leadership a bit more specifically then. So leadership and management, what's the biggest lessons in those areas that you've taken from your career so far?
Well, obviously, it's being clear, right? Being clear, being kind. I think the understanding that trust is built one conversation at a time and one experience at a time. We have this myth that you either trust somebody or you don't trust someone. Trust is either present or it's not present. It's much different than that. Trust is on a spectrum. Trust, I trust you right now, you and I, if we were in the same room, I would trust you if I had to step out for a minute to leave my phone and my purse and everything in the room. I would totally trust you. In this moment, however, I would not trust you to pick up my grandchild at daycare or to mail in my vote or to take my ATM to the bank machine and take money out. I don't know you that well. I might over time as we have conversations and experiences, right? But we operate in this paradigm that we either need to fully trust or not trust at all. And when it comes to employees, the difficulty there, and it took me a long time to learn this and figure this out, the difficulty is that once somebody makes a mistake or they mess up or they let us down, we go right back to zero trust. And what I've learned is it's possible to go back to the last place where you had trust and then begin having conversations and experience to build trust back up again. We don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, for lack of a better saying. And so that's been one of the biggest leadership things that I've learned. I've also learned from my parents, who had businesses my whole entire life, just about the value of really understanding what it is you offer and offering that with integrity and in the absolute best way you can, and to really focus on the clients that you have in front of you who are showing up, and to keep figuring out how to provide the services that really support them and continue to make their journey. That a referral is 100 times more valuable than a new prospect. So I've been fortunate enough to build my business primarily on referrals or people that have had experiences with me. And I'm really grateful for that. That has been the biggest thing. And I've learned that from my parents, my father always used to say, you can make your worst customer your best customer just by doing the right thing. And so those are the things that I have lived by and built my business by are the things that made my parents successful.
It's two very good lessons there. And yeah, I mean, the point you make about trust, that's a really good way of looking at it, actually. And you're right, you don't hear many people talk about it in those terms, but it's kind of a gradual growth, isn't it? It's kind of the sum of your experience personally with that individual, and it's going to be a different level of trust with each person you deal with most of the time.
And in each situation.
Yeah.
Trust is very situational.
Yeah.
Right, depends on the circumstances and what's happening and everything. And we rate it as either I trust you or I don't trust you. And once you label an employer, you decide that you don't trust them, or vice versa for leadership. Once you decide you don't trust them, then we throw that out and we begin to have all kinds of problems instead of trying to look at it in that segmented way and working on it.
Yeah, definitely. Another point I'd make, I think, is a lot of leaders forget that trust is a two-way street.
Yes.
They think about it only in terms of, do I trust that employee, without really thinking so much, does that employee trust me? Do they trust and respect me enough to actually do what I'm asking them to do because they understand I'm asking it for a reason, for example?
Yes.
And I think that's where a lot of people can go astray, sadly.
Yes. Well, and there's a very real thing called the power paradox. I don't know if you've heard about it. Mm-hmm. But the higher a leader moves up in power, the more that they get this kind of amnesia about the value of feedback, the value of building relationships, all of that. And they get this kind of egotistical view of this expert status. Like, I know what I need to know, right? Which is why I really encourage leaders. A lot of leaders contact me and they say, hey, I want you to come in and work on culture in my company. And I say, okay, what part are you going to be in this implementation? They're like, oh, I don't need to come. Yeah, no, you do. You really do.
You definitely do. Yeah,
you definitely do. But but we get to this place where we think if we're this high up, and it's a real thing that happens in the brain. They've done research on it. It's called the power paradox. And we see it in a lot of our political leaders, a lot of the high tech leaders that we see making big flaws, and you're like, didn't anybody tell them that was a bad idea? But they stop getting feedback. They stop seeking it or even welcoming it. They develop a lot of people around them who will say yes to anything to keep their job.
Yeah, and sadly, parts of Europe are seeing the extreme outcome of that kind of thing, aren't they, at the moment, one could argue.
Yes. Yeah, it's tough. Yeah. It's a really tough one. And so, you know, that's why my mission and my focus is about helping leaders and people who are aspiring to leadership to become more self-aware and be able to hack these natural things that happen within us because they don't serve us well.
Well, I think we've talked enough about what leaders do wrong. It's too easy to fall into the grumble, so I'm going to move on.
I know. Yeah.
You're
100%
right. Yeah. I think that says a lot about the kind of the trend of leadership, though, doesn't it? Is how many bad leaders there are. But anyway, I said I was going to move on. So changing topic then, you know, what with all the leaders you've worked with, what have you seen people get right the most often as leaders?
Yes. So I'm working currently with the head of one of the largest state agencies in California. And he is thinking about succession. And I've been working with him for about 4 years now with him and his team. He has 7,000 people underneath him. And his thinking about succession, which I love, is about how are we lifting everybody up in the organization? It's not about who is going to succeed me. Like, who am I developing that can step into my role? It's about how are we lifting everybody up? And so it's very, very rare for a governmental agency to put as much focus on the type of leadership development that he is putting on, but he's extremely committed to this. And so we are working with him, his leadership team, his 10, you know, the 10 people directly under him, and then all of their managers under them, to help them to understand how to develop those high potential people and how to be thinking about lifting up leadership throughout the whole organization. That makes my heart so happy, because so often we promote people, as was the case with me way back in the beginning of my career, we promote people who do the tasks really, really well. And we say, well, they must be ready to lead the team because they can do the work really well. Well, here's the truth. There are people who are high performers. They're very motivated from being high performers. They love to operate as a lone wolf. They love to be super successful, knocking tasks out of the park. They get promoted into a managerial or leadership position, and all they do, and I know because I coach them, is pine for the ability to do the work that they love so much, right? And now they're micromanaging, and now they're getting in everyone's business, and their employees aren't happy because they can't let go of the work and think strategically and lead and manage people and develop people. And so he's really committed to building up leadership in everybody in the appropriate way. And so I absolutely love that. I love working with him. I love hearing about his vision and mission, and it's very unusual. And he heads a technology division. So it's also incredibly unusual in that realm, because tech people traditionally are very linear thinkers, concrete, sequential, and very focused on tasks and output. And so he's a very unique unique leader in government. And so I just love learning from him.
Yeah, he sounds like a dream client.
He is. He's wow. Wonderful. Yes, he's going to be retiring in a couple of years. I'm a little sad.
Yeah, that is a shame. But
yeah.
But good for the people who he's leaving behind, isn't it?
Because he has prepared them. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a really nice story. Yeah. That kind of accidental manager problem, yeah, I hear about that so many times. On the one hand, it's really unfair on the people who are, as you say, they're really happy, they're performing really well, they don't want to make that move up to manager, they're quite content where they are. And sometimes they're not given a choice. It's like, if you want a pay rise, this is where you have to go.
Right.
And then the other side of it is, you know, once you've taken that person, whether they wanted the next step up to manager or not, you then throw them in at the deep end and don't give them any training on how to actually do that new job. People just sort of ignore the fact that it's a totally different skill set to what they were doing before.
Well, and I think we need to begin looking at it differently about how do we reward the people who are really high performers? How can we put a system in place so that the only way to get a raise is not to go into managing people? Right? There has to be a reward system. So in a lot of places, your high-performing salespeople have the ability to earn more than people in management because they're on a commission basis. Now, that's not the solution for people who are doing project work and all of that, to have commissions and bonuses. But it is something to think about, is how do we reward those people so that they are willing to stay doing the work that they do well and that contributes to the good of the whole. And those are the questions we have to grapple with as we think about work in, you know, 2023, 2024, 2025. What does it look like, particularly with so many people resigning or doing this whole quiet quitting thing or whatever? What does work really look like? How do we measure success? That's a big question.
Yeah, and I think there are other ways of doing it. I think particularly if you're looking at kind of specialist areas, there are ways of sort of developing a specialism progression that doesn't have to be linked to managing people.
Yes.
I guess that's harder in some industries than others. Might be quite difficult in, I don't know, the hospitality industry, for example. But then maybe not. You know, maybe there are equivalent qualifications and people can progress that way instead.
Yeah. It's just a shift away from how we've always done things, and we are very slow to shift away.
Mm, yeah. Indeed. Yes. Yeah. The eternal change management problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, knowing how to have those difficult conversations, it's and doing that in a productive way, that's going to be a crucial skill for nearly any job, but especially so for a leader or a manager. What advice would you give to a new leader then who is facing that challenge for the first time?
So the first advice that I give is to be aware of the energy that you are bringing to the room or to the conversation. So important. We get on the treadmill of going from meeting to meeting, conversation to conversation, and you know, virtual meetings have made it even worse because we used to get up from one meeting room, go down the hall, get a drink of water, say hi to somebody on the way or whatever, and then enter a second meeting room. Now you just click a button and you're in the next meeting. So people are forgetting to schedule even 5 minutes between meetings to just breathe. You show up in the next meeting and you're bringing all that energy with you into the room. It's very confusing for the people in the room because in the absence of information, we create stories. We always put ourselves in the middle of the story. So it's like, oh, here's David. Wow, he's in a bad mood today. What did I do to upset him? Or he's really tense. This meeting's going to go badly. We pollute the environment with our energy. So one of the mantras or principles of the program is be responsible for the energy you bring. And it's as simple as remembering to pause multiple times during the day, long enough to just breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth and bring yourself to center, right? Whatever happened before, you can deal with later. And whatever you fear or you're worried about is coming up or might be presenting itself in this meeting, that's all future tripping. You don't know what's going to happen. You need to be fully present in this moment as a leader. And people are depending on you to be clear, to be centered, to be focused, and to be consistent in your energy. And so that is the biggest thing that I encourage new leaders to work on, is to get off the hamster wheel long enough to just come back to center and enter the meeting from that place. Enter the next conversation from that place. At the end of the day, every employee, all they want is to be seen and heard. Even if you don't agree with them, even if you can't do what they ask you to do or what they think they need, they want to be heard about that. And if you are not being present with people, they are not feeling heard. They're not feeling heard. And so that's when they begin to get louder in their actions or inaction, right? They begin to get louder because they want so desperately to be heard. So that's what I encourage new leaders right off the bat, is to begin working on that leadership presence. How do you want to be known when you're not in the room? What do you want people to think and feel about your leadership?
Yeah, that's really good advice. And I think, yeah, the kind of the Zoom issue, the Zoom etiquette, the Zoom kind of, I don't know, overload. I find that challenging sometimes, just being able to have the time to prepare in between meetings, let alone just breathe.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's why I quite like some of those automation tools like Calendly, because you can automatically build in gaps between your meetings. So it will be just go in there by itself. Anyway.
I encourage every leader to block out time in their calendar. That because if you don't, it'll get all sucked up. And at the end of the day, or even partway through the day, you're now too exhausted to think critically, to have empathy and compassion, to see the big picture, to problem solve in the way that you need to or strategize. If you don't, if you're just meeting after meeting after meeting, you are not doing the work of a leader.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even the highest performers don't have the headspace to do back-to-back meetings for a full work day and bring the same energy to all of them. It's just not, we're not wired like that. I mean, maybe there's one or two in a million or something, but on the whole, How does your approach to these difficult conversations help organizations build a healthy and positive work culture then?
here's the reality. When people stop communicating is when you're in trouble. You know, there's the adage that I've heard a few times, when your most verbal person stops talking, you've got a big problem, right? So we need to be able to have these conversations to be able to have healthy conflict. Conflict is where new ideas get created. They come out of that friction of conflict, where new solutions get developed, all of those types of things. And the difference between healthy conflict and unhealthy conflict is, in unhealthy conflict, somebody wins and somebody loses. Somebody's right and somebody's wrong. People feel personally attacked in unhealthy conflict, right? Feelings get hurt. In healthy conflict, it can look exactly like unhealthy conflict. It can be passionate, can be loud, can be difficult. But what we're striving for is the win that's going to get us all to the next level, right? The solution that's going to benefit the good of the whole. That's what we're striving for. And it's not personal. People aren't holding grudges. Somebody doesn't win and somebody doesn't lose. We all win. And so this program, Navigating Challenging Dialogue, teaches people how to engage and participate even when we don't see eye to eye. And that is invaluable to organizations. That it builds culture, it builds trust, it builds loyalty, it builds excitement, it builds all those kinds of things. And you have people that can operate on a higher level at the end.
I think a great first step as well is just being able to tell the difference between those two types of conflict. I won't mention any names, but a former boss of mine once, he read some management book, I can't remember which one it was, but it talked about conflict being positive. And the lesson he took away from that was that arguments are good. So he would start arguments. And he couldn't tell that they were unhealthy ones because it did become very quickly about winning or someone being right. And
yes.
And everyone left the argument feeling like, well, what was that about? Why did we just have to have a fight about that?
Yes, that is not the point.
Indeed.
Leadership Heroes.
Well, we're nearly at the end. We have one last question, and this is always one of my favorite questions. So I call it Leadership Heroes.
Okay.
So the question is, can you please pick one person, alive or dead, past or present, real or fictional, if you want, who, in your opinion, would perfectly embody leadership, and tell me why?
I think right now the founder of Patagonia, I don't know if you're familiar with him, Yvonne Chouinard. His name is tricky to say for me. I believe right now he's my leadership hero. He's been my leadership hero for a little while because when he at some point in his career wrote the book Let My People Surf, and I love that concept because it was about people are their most creative when their brain is sort of removed from the work environment. They're surfing, they're mountain climbing, they're doing whatever their thing is, and the brain is slightly offline, and the solutions to tough conflicts come forward, or the relationship that is built through that type of perseverance and doing those activities. And I know that's true for me. I'm a horse person, and when I'm horseback riding, often all of a sudden I'll be like, oh, yes, okay, that's the solution, because my brain is no longer consciously engaged in that. So I loved him then when he wrote that. And now that he has decided that all profits from Patagonia are going towards causes for preventing global warming and taking care of the environment, bold move, but he's essentially saying that from now on, Patagonia, all their profits are going towards protecting the world, protecting the earth, and making it better. And I love, love, love companies that have a moral and social compass towards contributing to the world in that way. So right now, he would be it. Probably if you ask me tomorrow, it might be someone different, but today that's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's a great one. I was just reading about it the other week. So, yeah, I mean, Patagonia is a few billion, isn't it? It's yes. Quite a lot of money. Like, it's a billionaire.
Yes. It's a lot of money. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, setting a very clear example to some of the other billionaires, isn't he?
Yes.
Mind you, Bill Gates does a lot, doesn't he? Maybe not in the same way, but he does a lot for kind of the world and certain communities and things, doesn't he? So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people do. I think this is a very bold statement, though, to say taking all the profit. This company only exists now to in service of protecting the earth.
Absolutely.
That's a huge statement.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful, definitely. Yeah. Well, what a great pick.
Thank you. I had to actually Google how to pronounce his last name because I'm like,
oh, no.
Really tricky one.
Well, I don't have it in front of me, so I'm not even going to try. it's another new one as well, though. So we've not had a repetition for a little while. So I'm pleased with that.
Good.
Well, that's been great. Thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you.
Last thing is just if you have a website or a particular service that you'd like to point the listeners towards, if any of them want to work with you or learn more.
Yeah. So people can find me on LinkedIn easily. It's Beth Wonson, Wonson. But my website is ncdsolution.com. And we have so many free resources on there for managing effectively, having difficult conversations. And we do trainings. And of course, I have my newest book, Turn This Conversation Around, which is a great read, and it has the four-step process right in it. You can get it on Amazon or any local bookseller, and there's links on the website. So ncdsolution.com. I love to hear from people, and so I'd love to hear from all your listeners.
Great. Thanks very much. And I'll put the links and everything in the episode description as well, so people can click on it and find you as well. And that's all we've got time for today. Thank you again, Beth, for some great insights and some useful advice there for leaders trying to navigate those challenging discussions. If you would like to learn more about what Beth does and perhaps visit her website, get a copy of one of her books, then the web address is in the episode description, so you can click on that at your leisure. And in the event you'd like to learn more about leading with integrity and hear more from me, as if these podcast episodes weren't enough, I'm sure they're not. Maybe they are. Anyway, I'm excited to make an announcement today. Well, in fact, I made an announcement last week in one of my free webinars, if anyone managed to attend that. The announcement is this. I'm launching in January a new totally live online leadership training course. It's called the Leadership Starter Kit Live, and it will be taking a previously on-demand course and turning it into a live, interactive weekly training. So the idea is that it'll be a lot more engaging and you'll get a lot more out of it and we'll be able to participate with questions and so on and so forth. So as I say, very exciting. It will be live. If you'd like to register or learn more about it, there is a new link in the episode description, but I will read it out for you as well. That link is www.leading-with-integrity.co.uk/free webinar. That'll take you to a website where you can sign up to attend one of the webinars. And on the webinar, you'll learn all about the Leadership Starter Kit Live, how to access it, etc. I'm also offering a discount for the first 10 people to book onto that course. So time is of the essence, as they say. So hopefully I'll be hearing from some of you very soon and maybe see you on a webinar. And I'm sure we'll have a call booked before you know it. And that's all I've got for today. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you will listen again next week. And in the meantime, remember, be a leader, not a boss.